From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
An immediate withdrawal of our troops in Iraq or the broader Middle East, as some have called for, would only embolden the terrorists.
When Casey was told that he was going to be welcomed with chocolates and flowers as a liberator, well, the people of Iraq saw it differently. They saw him as an occupier.
President Bush and Cindy Sheehan have both returned to Crawford. We'll speak with another founder of Gold Star Families for Peace, Celeste Zapala, as well as a peace activist in Idaho, where President Bush just addressed the National Guard. And we'll talk to a Marine who's recently returned from Iraq. Then to Texas death row to look at the case of Frances Newton. She's scheduled to die on September 14th. She'd be the first African-American woman executed in Texas since the Civil War.
I cope knowing that I have people fighting for me, that believing in me, and believing that the right thing will be done.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has launched what could be called a major defensive against the growing movement demanding he announce a clear timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. On Wednesday, as Bush faced the lowest approval ratings of his presidency, he delivered a major address in which he said clearly he is not considering pulling out.
We mourn the loss of every life. We pray for their loved ones. These brave men and women gave their lives for a cause that is just and necessary for the security of our country. And now we will honor their sacrifice by completing their mission.
As Bush spoke, reports began to emerge that some 1,500 more troops are now being sent to Iraq ahead of two major votes in the country. To make his address, Bush went to territory no doubt considered safe by his handlers, Idaho, where Bush received more than two-thirds of the vote in the last election. The venue was a large hall filled with members of the National Guard and selected military families. In his speech, Bush made a point of talking about military families he's met with and who he says support him. Bush's remarks came as Cindy Sheehan arrived back in Crawford, Texas, to rejoin the now internationally known vigil she began 2 weeks ago. She was picked up at the airport by fellow protesters, some of whom served in the military. As she arrived, Sheehan said, quote, "This is where I belong until August 31st, like I told the president." After folk singer Joan Baez performed last night, Sheehan addressed her supporters.
And that's what George Bush did. He put our kids in another person's country. And Casey was killed by insurgents. He wasn't killed by terrorists. He was killed by Shiite militia who wanted, they wanted him out of the country. When Casey was told that he was going to be welcomed with chocolates and flowers as a liberator, well, the people of Iraq saw it differently. They saw him as an occupier.
Cindy Sheehan spent the past 6 days in Los Angeles, where she was with her sick mother. Meanwhile, pro-war activists and military families were en route to Crawford from California on a tour called You Don't Speak for Me, Cindy. They plan to hold a pro-Bush rally in town on Saturday. With the stage set for a possible showdown in Crawford this weekend, more prominent figures are lending their support to Sheehan. In recent days, musicians Joan Baez and Steve Earle have performed at Camp Casey. Veteran civil rights activists and many veterans of the Iraq War are camped out there. On Wednesday, former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson issued a statement saying, quote, "The Bush White House and its right-wing allies are responding to Cindy Sheehan and the military family's vigil in Central Texas in the same way that they always respond to bad news, by unleashing personal attacks and smears against her." Meanwhile, the White House is denying that President Bush is on vacation. Administration spokesperson David Almacy said the reason that Bush is in Crawford, Texas is due to the renovation of the West Wing of the White House. He said, quote, "He's operating on a full schedule. He's just doing it from the ranch instead of from the White House." He continued, "The only week he had officially off was this last week." Just hours after it said it had completed its withdrawal operations from Gaza and the West Bank, Israel issued orders to seize Palestinian land to build a massive weaponized separation barrier in a plan that it would essentially annex the West Bank's largest Jewish settlement to Jerusalem. The U.S. State Department said it opposed the plan, while Palestinians charge Israel issued the confiscation orders in the West Bank while world attention was still focused on the forcible removal of Jewish settlers and demolition of their homes by Israeli bulldozers. The massive barrier would cut some Palestinians off from areas of Jerusalem. A day after calling for the assassination of Venezuela's democratically elected president, Hugo Chavez, right-wing Christian extremist Pat Robertson has apologized. He said, quote, "Is it right to call for assassination? No, and I apologize for that statement. I spoke in frustration that we should accommodate the man who thinks the U.S. is out to kill him," Robertson said. But incredibly, before Robertson issued that apology, he went on national television Wednesday and denied he'd ever made the remark. Robertson issued his denial during an interview with former ambassador at large to Venezuela and outspoken Chavez critic Thor Halvorsen on the 700 Club.
And I didn't say assassination. I said our special forces should, quote, take him out. And take him out can be a number of things, including kidnapping. There are a number of ways to take out a dictator from power besides killing him. I was misinterpreted by the AP, but that happens all the time.
Well, what is interesting about that statement is the fact that it's not true. Robertson's comments calling for Chavez's assassination were actually broadcast on his own program, the 700 Club, on Tuesday.
You know, I don't know about this doctrine of assassination, but if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think that we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war.
The White House has resisted calls for President Bush to repudiate Robertson, who's been a major supporter of President Bush and the Republican Party, even running as a candidate for president in 1988. The organization, the American Legion, has voted at its national convention to target peace activists and the anti-war movement. The group boasts nearly 3 million members. The group's national commander called for an end to all public protests and what he called media events against the war, even though they're protected by the Bill of Rights. Thomas Cadmus told the convention, quote, "The American Legion will stand against anyone and any group that would demoralize our troops or, worse, endanger their lives by encouraging terrorists to continue their cowardly attacks against freedom-loving peoples." The delegates voted to use whatever means necessary to, quote, "ensure the united backing of the American people to support our troops and the global war on terrorism," unquote. As the American Legion declares war on peace activists, President Bush and his allies continue to find support among some in the media for what many see as a smear campaign against Cindy Sheehan and other anti-war military families. On Monday's edition of MSNBC's Hardball, White House correspondent Nora O'Donnell labeled anti-war demonstrators Bush's property in Crawford anti-war extremists. The comments came in an exchange with FBI whistleblower-turned-congressional candidate Colleen Rowley.
You're a Democrat running for Congress. It was reported that Republican leaders in your state were just thrilled that you had decided to align yourself with anti-war extremists. Do you think that this could affect your race for Congress?
Well, I will quickly correct the record that they are not anti-war extremists. The majority of the people I saw down in Crawford were actually veterans groups. There were military families.
But, Colleen, they do oppose the war in Iraq, do they not?
Yes, they do, but that does not make them, I guess the term extremists. They're really, I think, reflective of mainstream America in many ways.
FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley responding to MSNBC's Nora O'Donnell. Thanks to MediaMatters.org for posting that clip. It's emerged that the Department of Veterans Affairs has been issuing tombstones to soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan that some say amount to promotional material for the so-called war on terror. Families of fallen soldiers have received government-furnished headstones engraved with Operation Enduring Freedom or Operation Iraqi Freedom. The government says the engravings are optional, but families have begun coming forward to say they had no choice in the matter. Former Senator Max Cleland, who lost both legs and an arm in Vietnam and headed the Veterans Administration under President Carter, called the practice, quote, "a little bit of glorified advertising." The Bush administration's reportedly replacing the director of the Justice Department's Statistic Bureau after he complained that senior political officials at the department were seeking to cover up newly compiled data on racial profiling of black and Latino drivers. The official, Lawrence Greenfeld, was named by President Bush to his post in 2001. The case has stirred anger among many Justice Department statisticians who say their independence in analyzing important law enforcement data has been compromised. According to the New York Times, Greenfeld told his staff several weeks ago that he'd been asked to move on after 23 years at the agency. According to the Times, Greenfeld was told to remove certain findings on racial profiling from Justice Department press releases and refused to do so. The study examined what happens when drivers of various races are stopped by police. It found Latino drivers were searched or had their vehicles searched by the police more than 11% of the time. African Americans, 10% of the time, where whites were only searched 3.5% of the time. Blacks and Hispanics were also subjected to force or the threat of force more often than whites, and the police were much more likely to issue tickets to Latinos rather than simply giving them a warning, the study found. The government-approved press release that Greenfeld objected to said only that the rate at which whites, blacks, and Latinos were stopped was about the same. And those are some of the headlines. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers out there.
Well, Juan, you have a very interesting piece in today's Daily News called Oil Fat Cats versus Hugo Chavez.
Yes, Amy. Well, I went in my column into what Hugo Chavez was doing yesterday while Pat Robertson was issuing his variety of corrections to his original statement that only confused matters. But Chavez was in Jamaica meeting with the Prime Minister of Jamaica, P.J. Patterson, and announcing a new agreement by which Venezuela will be providing Jamaica highly discounted oil supplies, actually at $40 a barrel, 22,000 barrels of oil a day, which the price yesterday for oil on the markets was $65 a barrel. So this is going to represent about $200 million a year in savings to Jamaica for its oil. One of the things that we've all been seeing across the country, this enormous increase in gasoline prices, and yes, Americans are suffering quite a bit from it, but the people in third world countries are suffering much more. In price of gasoline, the Dominican Republic is now $4 a gallon, and in Jamaica, it's over $3.50 a gallon. And these are much more poorer countries, and the importing of oil is bankrupting their government budgets. So that Chavez announced a month ago that he was going to provide discounted oil to more than a dozen Caribbean neighbors, including Cuba, Jamaica, the Dominican Republic, and many of the other smaller island countries in the Caribbean. It's going to be an enormous savings to them. It's no surprise that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld is down in Latin America, was down in Latin America recently, trying to shore up anti-Chavez sentiment, and that suddenly Pat Robertson puts up this trial balloon. Why don't we assassinate Chavez? Clearly, the Bush administration is worried that Hugo Chavez is gaining increasing support for his willingness to use oil as a weapon to assist the impoverished countries of Latin America.
And not only poor countries of Latin America, but here in this country, offering poor communities cheaper oil.
Yes, yes. And so I think that the Robertson statements are no accident. And the fact that in his statement yesterday, he specifically said at the end, at least my remarks have gotten our government to focus more attention on a problem.
Well, Juan, now to today's top story.
Yes, and today's top story, President Bush mounted a major defense of the war in Iraq this week as he faces the lowest approval rating of his presidency. On Wednesday, Bush spoke in Idaho before an audience of about 9,500 people, including members of the Idaho National Guard and other military families. Idaho is one of Bush's strongest centers of support. The address followed one on Tuesday in the Republican stronghold of Utah. Anti-war groups kept the pressure on the president during his brief trip away from his Crawford Ranch. About 150 protesters gathered across a parking lot from the arena where Bush spoke last night.
The president's remarks came as Cindy Sheehan arrived back in Crawford to rejoin the now internationally known vigil she began 2 weeks ago. She spent the last 6 days in Los Angeles to care for her ailing mother. While Bush didn't say Sheehan's name in the address, he clearly sought to discredit calls made by her and her supporters for an immediate withdrawal of troops from Iraq.
I made a decision. America will not wait to be attacked again. Our doctrine is clear. We will confront emerging threats before they fully materialize. And if you harbor a terrorist, you're just as guilty as the terrorists. We will stay on the offense. We'll complete our work in Afghanistan and Iraq. An immediate withdrawal of our troops in Iraq or the broader Middle East, as some have called for, would only embolden the terrorists and create a staging ground to launch more attacks against America and free nations. So long as I'm the president, we will stay, we will fight, and we will win the war on terror.
President Bush also broke a 2-year policy of avoiding specific mention of casualties in Iraq and gave a figure about the deaths of U.S. soldiers for the second speech in a row. In what seemed to be a direct contrast to Cindy Sheehan, Bush played up the case of a military mother who supports the Iraq war.
There are a few things in life more difficult than seeing a loved one go off to war. And here in Idaho, a mom named Tammy Pruitt I think she's here knows that feeling 6 times over. Tammy has 4 sons serving in Iraq right now with the Idaho National Guard, Eric, Evan, Greg, and Jeff. Last year, her husband Leon and another son, Aaron, returned from Iraq where they helped train Iraqi firefighters in Mosul. Tammy says this, and I want you to hear this. I know that if something happens to one of the boys, they would leave this world doing what they believe, what they think is right for our country. And I guess you couldn't ask for a better way of life than giving it for something that you believe in. America lives in freedom because the families like the Pruitts.
Tammy Pruitt was in the audience with her husband, Leon. President Bush kissed her on the cheek after the speech. The Pruitts, who were featured earlier this year on CNN, said they received a call about a week ago from the White House requesting their presence.
After his address, Bush met privately with military families of soldiers killed in Iraq before returning to his Crawford ranch later that evening. Hours earlier, Cindy Sheehan returned to Crawford to continue her vigil, demanding that Bush meet with her as well. The site is named Camp Casey after her son, who was killed in Iraq in April 2004. After a performance by the legendary folk singer Joan Baez, Cindy got up on stage and greeted the audience. She began by addressing some of the attacks that had been leveled at her by the right-wing media.
The hardest thing for me to hear, I don't care about them talking about me being a crackpot or a media whore or a tool of the left, you know. I'm like, if I truly was a media whore, do you think I would, like, maybe get myself fixed up a little bit before I went on? That doesn't bother me at all, but what bothers me so much is when they say I'm dishonoring my son's memory by what I'm doing, that my son would be ashamed of me, or that what they really like to say is I'm pissing or shitting or spitting on his grave. And look what Casey has started. You know, I'm here because of Casey. We're all here because of Casey. And, you know, literally there's over 2,000 of our brave young people and tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis. And I know they're behind us. And I see them, all their faces on your faces. But Casey was such a gentle, kind, loving person. He never even got in one fist fight his whole life. Nobody even hated him enough to punch him, let alone kill him. And that's what George Bush did. He put our kids in another person's country. And Casey was killed by insurgents. He wasn't killed by terrorists. He was killed by Shiite militia who wanted... They wanted him out of the country. When Casey was told that he was going to be welcomed with chocolates and flowers as a liberator, well, the people of Iraq saw it differently. They saw him as an occupier.
Cindy Sheehan speaking last night at Camp Casey, just after she came back. This is Democracy Now! When we come back from break, we'll be joined by another of the founders of Gold Star Families for Peace, Celeste Zapala. And we'll speak with a Marine who recently returned from Iraq. We'll also talk with one of the people who were protesting in Idaho. Stay with us.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night. You're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. Oh, the copper bosses kill you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. More than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die, says Joe. I didn't die. And standing there, as big as life, and smiling. We went on to organize. Hi, Jody. Went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, bypassing Crawford in every mine and defend their rights. Is there you find Joe Hill? Is there...
Joan Baez singing last night at Camp Casey. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 350 radio and television stations around the country and the largest public media collaboration in the United States. And we are podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez on the phone with us right now from Philadelphia. We're joined by Celeste Zapala, one of the founders of Gold Star Families for Peace, the mother of Sergeant Sherwood Baker, who was killed in Iraq April 26th in an explosion in Baghdad. Baker was the first member of the Pennsylvania Army National Guard to die in combat since World War II. In our studio here in New York, we're joined by Alex Rybov. He was part of a Marine Corps artillery unit during the initial invasion of Iraq in March 2003. He lives here in New York and is co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And we're joined in Idaho by Liz Paul, an organizer with the Idaho Peace Coalition. President Bush just in Idaho last night. I wanted to start with Celeste Zapala and ask Celeste to respond to what President Bush said yesterday in Idaho. He singled out Tammy Pruitt, whose four boys are in Iraq last night, are in Iraq right now. She was sitting with her husband. And Bush said, as we just heard, Tammy says this, and I want you to hear this, President Bush said, "I know that if something happens to one of the boys, they would leave this world doing what they believe, what they think is right for our country. And I guess you couldn't ask for a better way of life than giving it for something you believe in." President Bush said America lives in freedom because of families like the Pruitts. Your response?
Well, I guess, Amy, I was a little shocked to hear that kind of statement. And what went through my mind was, God willing, she never has to have that experience. I just found it an unusual thing to say, and thinking that the reality of that loss would be so devastating, and it is. It's so terrible and painful, and that to kind of act as if this would be a desirable thing, I just found it appalling and kind of opportunistic on the president's part. And I also thought about all the families who are sitting in Crawford who have already lost someone and who are ignored. I also thought of the family from Georgia, the Waste family, who have five family members who have served a total of 58 months of service in Iraq, and they're opposed to the war. I mean, it's almost, you know, I don't want to be part of dueling families. And I respect the service of all of the people who would give their lives towards the country. I mean, that's a whole different thing than the policy of this administration. And, I listened to that speech, and it seemed so jingoistic and actually empty, because there wasn't actually much in terms of a plan. It was kind of a lot of flag-waving, well-scripted. You know, I think the president's scriptwriters did a real nice job. But in terms of giving our country a direction, of telling us any new information about when our soldiers are coming home, or about plans for peace, or answering any of the questions that all of us have been raising about the war, you know, it was shallow. And I, you know, respond to it very much as representing all the families who were waiting for their turn to speak, and feel that, you know, the president so carefully talks to people who agree with him. You have to have a ticket that says you agree in order to get near the president. And if we're a real democracy, how is it that the voices of people who disagree, who have served, who have paid the ultimate price, how is it our families can't be heard? How are we belittled and ignored?
Well, Celeste, I'd like to ask you, what's your reaction to some of these commentators on Fox News calling the folks in Crawford anti-war extremists?
Oh, isn't that silly? You know, what does that mean, anti-war extremists? I'm a peace extremist, you know? I want people to start taking responsibility for the behavior of their nation. I want my representatives to get a spine and stand up and start leading. I want accountability for all the terrible mistakes that have occurred that have put us in this dreadful situation. I proudly wear the banner of a badge of being a person for peace. And, you know, people can criticize. It's okay. They need to do that. They get paid to do that. So be it. You know, part of what I hope to do when we began this journey of speaking the truth was to get national dialogue going, and part of the national dialogue will be the people who disagree and criticize and find fault and try to shame us. But I would say to any of those folks, you know, especially the commentators, you know, kind of the rabid commentators, you know, talk to me after you have a loved one serving. Then we can have a different conversation.
Well, thank you. And that was actually, just to correct the record, that was Norah O'Donnell of MSNBC, not Fox.
Okay.
I don't want to blame Fox for things other than what they already do.
On MSNBC, they call them extremists. On Fox, traitors.
Yes.
Right.
But I'd like to bring in also Alex Rybov. You were in Iraq in the initial invasion. Could you talk to us a little about your how you reached your viewpoints on the war and decided to organize a veterans group against the war?
Right. The thing is, before going to Iraq, the reasons were questionable. We even had our first sergeant come out and tell us, you know, this man's a veteran of the first Persian Gulf War, been in the Marine Corps 20-plus years, and he actually, after our commanding officer told us that, yes, we're going to Iraq, he came out to talk to us and said, in going to Iraq, don't think you're going to be heroes. Don't think you're going there to topple Saddam, find weapons of mass destruction, or make Iraq safe for democracy. He said, you're going there for one reason alone, and that's oil. And this is our first sergeant telling
us.
Where
were you when he said that?
This was at Camp Lejeune. This was on base. And, you know, a lot of the younger guys were taken back by this because these were, you know, it's not the official reason for going to Iraq. This is not what's being plastered all over the media. But, you know, guys like myself who had been in for a while, just we knew the government was involved in underhanded things, and it seemed this time that we would be involved in one.
How old are you?
What's that?
How old are you?
I'm 22. At the time we were going to Iraq, I was 20. So we found out, we packed up our gear, which was, you know, inadequate as far as totally unarmored vehicles. We received one ballistic plate for body armor instead of two. You're supposed to have one for your chest, one for your back. We actually had all of our vehicles, all things like that, were green camouflage. The green camouflage netting we actually put up in a combat zone. You know, it didn't do much as far as trying to hide us. Here's, you know, the desert, and here's this big green thing with, you know, silver cannon tubes sticking out from under.
If you were given one instead of two plates, did you put them on your front or your back?
Well, I kept mine in the front. We had certain guys that would kind of rotate them depending on situation. Sometimes we would get intelligence where we're supposedly going to get attacked from the west and, you know, we're going to get mortars or something. So guys would put the plate in their back so that way when they jump in their hole, they have some additional protection. And now as far as the ammunition trucks go and most of the vehicles, you know, all the vehicles were combat loading, meaning every vehicle had some amount of ammunition. And when we're hardening these vehicles by just putting sandbags in the floorboards, and you have, for example, an ammunition truck, 10,000 plus pounds of high explosives and artillery shells, those sandbags won't do anything. And so, you know, being in Iraq and seeing all kinds of things like, you know, dead bodies for the first time, seeing the results of our artillery fire. And, you know, seeing those, being artillery, you're firing upwards of 15 miles away. You don't get to see your target. You normally don't get to see the results. At one point, we had fired an Iraqi artillery unit, and passing by, we were told they were going to be on the right side of the road. Looking over there, I saw, you know, a piece of metal, another piece of metal further away, and everything else was just gone. It looked like the soil had been freshly tilled, like someone had put all the people, artillery pieces, anything that had been in the area into a giant blender, spun it around and poured it back over the ground. And, you know, every time we would see these kind of things, like, you know, dead bodies on the road, burnt and destroyed vehicles, we just keep going because, you know, mission accomplishment, we have position to get to, stuff like that. There was a time where we passed there was a wounded, you know, civilian had a gunshot wound in his thigh. We, you know, passed by because we had to keep going. And one of the main things, really, the thing that made the most impact on me in Iraq was going up to Tikrit. By this point, a lot of our cargo vehicles had the windshields blown out because of the concussion of firing, you know, these charges. Some of these gunpowder charges are in excess of 40 pounds. So windshield shattered, tossed it out. We're moving up the road maybe 45 miles an hour, and it's about 4 o'clock in the morning. And the way that the howitzer is towed, it's towed like a trailer. And, you know, some smart person must have come up with this because the barrel goes at about a 45 to 60 degree angle and lines up directly or almost directly with the windshield of the vehicle behind it. So the vehicle in front of us kicked up a lot of sand and dust. We weren't able to see them, and we ended up running into the howitzer, the barrel of the howitzer. And you can imagine something roughly the diameter and almost the length of a steel telephone pole went through where the windshield used to be, brushed my right shoulder, and went out the back of the cab, and we came to a stop. Now, after we reversed, the roof ended up really coming off our vehicle and falling to the ground. And finally, when we got moving, we're still kind of in a shock, and you couldn't smoke any cigarettes because it was nighttime. When daytime hit, you know, aside from smoking a lot of cigarettes, I looked at my right shoulder, and the desert uniforms are a pretty light color. And the entire right shoulder, was completely covered, was totally pitch black in gunpowder residue and carbon from this barrel, meaning that had it been another 6 inches to my left, I wouldn't be here right now. So given all these things that happened, at the time you're in Iraq, you really, for the most part, don't have time to deal with it because, you know, things are moving so fast and you inadvertently begin to, you know, block it out. It was after coming back and actually, seeing this stuff continue on CNN, and that's the only thing that was on in the chow hall, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, just seeing the body counts continue to rise on both sides. And, you know, maybe after a short time of this, something clicked and I realized this war is wrong. We should not be over there. And at the same time, I still have, you know, a year left in the Marines, so I really had to, you know, keep my mouth shut and wait till I got out.
Alex Reibel is one of the people who started Iraq Veterans Against the War here in New York. Also on the line with us is Liz Paul. And yesterday when President Bush was addressing the Idaho National Guard, she was just outside with a group of people. How many people were there, and why were you, Liz?
The president spoke yesterday morning in a big pavilion in Nampa, Idaho, and with a gigantic parking lot and stuff. And we had over 150 protesters. People had to show up 7:30 a.m., line the sidewalk in front of the Idaho Center, and, you know, a wide variety of signs, posters, banners, a lot of enthusiasm. And then the Idaho Center has what they call a free speech policy, and they allow some protesters to come onto the property, and they're segregated into groups of either two or three and placed in these little locations around the parking lot with little ropes around them. And so we had reserved a few of those sites as well. And we had two mothers who have sons serving in Iraq now, and then also in one of the areas. And then we had some the Veterans for Peace chapter here in Boise had members in one of them. So we were all there as tens, thousands of people. It felt like were lined up, just snaked around since early hours of the morning. And they would just slowly go by these free speech areas. And I spent some time with the moms for a while. And a lot of little kids coming in to see the president, and they're saying, "Mommy, what does that sign say? What does that sign say?" It's quite a moving experience, and everybody was respectful on both sides. So we were there to let the president know. I mean, we had protests in Idaho from touchdown on Monday to takeoff, early yesterday afternoon, and really an enormous outpouring of Idahoans to say to the president that we want to end the occupation, we want the troops home now. We certainly had a theme running through all the demonstrations that there are Cindy's and Casey's in every town across America, and the president may be able to come to Idaho and go mountain bike riding, but he is not going to escape the protests of those that are sick and tired of this war and want it ended now.
It's interesting, among the people that President Bush met with parents of those in Iraq who have lost their children or their husbands in one particular case. So a woman seeing Bush for the second time, and that would be the case with Cindy Sheehan, and they've used the argument that she already saw him. Celeste Zapala, you were in Utah when President Bush was there the day before in Salt Lake City, but you were speaking outside. What was that experience like? I mean, clearly going to places where the majority of people voted for President Bush in the last election.
It was a stunning experience to me. I had gone there with the hope that at least 200 people would come out to the Pioneer Park to hear what we had to say. And while driving to the park, I saw hundreds of people carrying signs walking the streets, and I was afraid they were demonstrators for Bush, and I was a little bit afraid thinking so many people would come out against us. And then I realized they were for us. There were coming from all directions with homemade signs saying, bring the troops home now. This war is based on lies. Lots of creative things, little kids, couples, old folks in wheelchairs, Mormons for peace. I mean, it was just an extraordinary thing. And the mayor of the city of Salt Lake came to speak at our rally, telling the whole city that he felt that the Bush administration has betrayed this country. So we ended up with about 2,000 people, where I had prayed for 200. And the feeling amongst the people, their willingness to stand there for a couple of hours and listen and participate and line the streets and cheer when trucks went by that honked at us and stuff. It was amazing to me. This was Salt Lake City. And if that level of passion exists there, then, I think we're opening up something pretty amazing across America.
Celeste Appel, I want to thank you for being with us. Gold Star Families for Peace, one of the founders, mother of Sergeant Sherwood Baker, who died in Iraq last year. Alex Rybov, thanks for being with us. Alex was in the Marine Corps artillery unit during the invasion of Iraq, co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And joining us from Idaho, Liz Paul, an organizer with the Idaho Peace Coalition. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at the case of a woman on death row in Texas. She's scheduled to die September 14th. Stay with us.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. My kill hand's tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five, they did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold, the ark of his testament is stowed, a throne from which I'm told all history does unfold.
Johnny Cash, The Mercy Seat, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, the state of Texas is scheduled to execute Frances Newton on September 14th. She was convicted of the 1988 murder of her husband and two children, allegedly to collect a $100,000 life insurance policy. Newton would be the first African-American woman executed by the state since the Civil War. Supporters say the courts should grant Frances Newton another trial based on new evidence. Two Dutch journalists recently interviewed the state prosecutor in charge of Newton's case. In that interview, Assistant District Attorney Ro Wilson contradicted a key piece of evidence that led to Newton's conviction. While prosecutors linked one gun to Newton, it now appears that there was a second gun that was never tested in the crime lab. This is Ro Wilson.
There's no second gun theory. The police recovered a gun from the apartment that belonged to the husband. It had not been fired. It was not involved in the offense. It was simply a gun he had there. So.
Texas leads the nation in the number of executions performed since the moratorium on capital punishment was lifted in the 1970s. Almost half the people on death row in Texas are African American, though only 12% of the population is. And in Harris County, where Frances Newton is from, the police crime lab is notorious for botching capital cases.
Another hurdle in Newton's case was her state-appointed attorney. She was originally represented by the infamous defense attorney Ron Mock, who lost so many capital cases that he is known as Death Row Mock. At least 16 of Mock's clients have gone to death row, and he has never won an acquittal in a capital case. He's been suspended from the bar twice. A colleague in Francis Newton's case says Mott told her that he had not thoroughly examined the evidence. In another high-profile case, Mock is known to have fallen asleep while defending Shaka Sankofa or Gary Graham in court. This report from the Committee to Free Francis Newton looks at Mock's role in that case.
Gary Graham had no money to hire a powerful lawyer, and Texas, unlike other states, has no system of public defenders. Graham's case ended up with lawyer Ron Mock.
Why didn't you go and talk to those eyewitnesses?
Because I made a decision at the beginning of that trial that I was not going to use those eyewitnesses.
But by leaving them out, you surely left him defenseless. I mean, Gary Graham was defenseless without that.
No way. No way.
Today, Mr. Mock is a well-heeled Houston lawyer. 20 years ago, however, he made a living taking a lot of death row cases. And the only way you know to have a lot of cases is to do very little on each one.
You obviously didn't believe in the man's innocence, did you?
Bull****. I did not make a determination of whether or not he was guilty. I never have done that. If I ever do that, I need to turn in my goddamn bar card.
According to this affidavit we've obtained, sworn by Mock's own private investigator at the time, Mr. Mock started from the premise that his client was guilty, therefore not worth wasting time and resources on.
I remember that from the first, Ron Mock insinuated that Gary was guilty. Because we assumed Gary was guilty from the start, we did not give his case the same attention we would routinely give a case.
Did Gary Graham get a defense?
No.
The lawyer who inherited this case in 1993 is absolute. Dick Burr points to the court record. Question after question from Ron Mock at Gary Graham's only trial, identifying Graham effectively as the killer.
He would have done better defending himself than having the lawyer who represented him.
So crucial witnesses were never heard in court, all the evidence too, and the trial itself was tainted by dubious defense. Three jurors have sworn affidavits, we have copies of them, saying they would not have voted to convict Gary Graham if they knew then what we have discovered now.
I would not have been able to convict Gary Graham on that evidence. I would have voted not guilty.
I cannot speak for the other jurors, but I would have had a serious doubt about him being guilty.
I would be in favor of delaying the execution until a jury can hear all of the evidence at the same time.
A look at the infamous defense attorney, Ron Mock. In a few minutes, we'll speak with the attorney for Francis Newton. But right now, we turn to Francis Newton herself on videotape. The following comments come from two interviews that she did with Dutch TV.
There are so many things that I don't know and I don't have answers to. But there are some things that I do know and that I know that if a jury knew, that they would have come to a different decision. The issue with the ballistics and the gun, they would have found out that the shell casings found there didn't match the weapon that they're saying is the murder weapon. That still hasn't been brought up in any of the court hearings, you know. And that's a major, that's something I didn't know, but that one of the attorneys working on the case now told me about. And those are like fingerprints. It's something that wasn't brought up in trial, you know, and I think that the jury should have been able to hear that. Mock has already said he was tired, he didn't want to take the case. So he didn't even look, I don't even think he looked at the police report, you know. One of my neighbors said they heard gunshots at 7:30. Why weren't they brought to testify in trial, you know? I just saw that in the clemency report, you know. I never knew that. That person should have been brought to trial to testify. That was something the defense was supposed to do and never did. What I know is that Sergeant Freeze told my father when he came to get me from my parents' house that there were two guns in the state's possession and the gun that I had wasn't the murder weapon. He told my father I would be back for that reason. Ron Mock, when I was first arrested and began going to court, he told us that there were two guns in the state's evidence, and the gun that I had wasn't the murder weapon. As far as the ballistics test coming back, saying that the gun in the state's evidence is the murder weapon, I don't know. You know, it may be, but what I know is that the gun I had the night that I left, the day that I left my apartment, is not the murder weapon. You know, I had heard Adrian and his brother talking earlier that day, and they had mentioned something about some trouble. And Adrian had told me he was quit using drugs. And so I looked in the cabinet, and I'm just trying to confirm that he's telling me the truth about the drugs. And so I looked in the cabinet where he normally kept drugs, and there wasn't any in there, but there was this gun there, and it was unfamiliar to me. And so hearing his conversation earlier with his brother Sterling, I took it. At that time, I know that my husband owed money to this guy he was selling drugs for. The guy is not a figment of my imagination, you know. That was real, that was going on. You know, and it had my husband so concerned at times. Sometimes we would come home and Alton would come out of his room and say, "Mom, Dad, sleep under the bed," you know, under his bed. We wouldn't see his car anywhere, but he'd be under the bed asleep. So that was something that was going on. And of course, when I find out that my husband and children were murdered, that was my first thought. Adrian was a very loving person, sort of easily led by his older brother. But he was a very loving person. I had my first child early, and my parents were very disappointed in me. But they said, "Okay, this happened. Don't make the mistake again," you know. And they encouraged me to continue being a teenager because I was a teenager. But at the same time, they helped me to be a good mother to my son. And Adrian's mom and dad were very supportive, as was he.
It must have been tough, so young.
You know, it really wasn't, because I had my big sisters and my big brothers, and so my son had all these aunts and uncles around and grandparents. It really wasn't tough. I mean, and I don't say that to encourage teenage pregnancy. I think that I was very blessed to have the support that I did.
Death row prisoner Frances Newton speaking earlier this year. She would be the first African-American woman executed by the state of Texas since the Civil War if she is not granted a stay before her execution date of September 14th. We go now to one of Frances Newton's attorneys, David Dow, of the University of Houston Law Center. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to begin, David Dow. Frances Newton was she's 40 now. That would make her 23 when she was initially arrested. She's been on death row now for 17 years. What's the state of the case right now, and what are your hopes in the next few months?
The state of the case right now is that late yesterday afternoon, the state courts ruled against us on the petition that we had filed in state court. That was the first legal document where we had raised the issue that you all alluded to a moment ago involving the acknowledgement by the prosecutor that police recovered a second gun, at least one additional gun, when they were investigating this crime. The state court didn't even address that issue at all. We currently have pending a clemency petition in front of the Board of Pardons and Paroles, and I expect that we'll be filing something in federal court sometime in the middle of next week.
What is the key issue that you feel needs to be raised right now for people to understand about Frances Newton?
Well, I think that there are really three key issues, and two of them are more important legally than the third, even though that's ironic. Because the issue that I think people need to understand that we're certainly including in everything that we file, but that is very difficult to raise at this stage of her case, is simply the fact that she's innocent and the fact that there isn't any evidence that suggests that she was guilty. Essentially, the state had three pieces of evidence at her trial. It had the motive evidence, which was the claim that she had purchased life insurance and then killed her family in order to collect that money. And it had two pieces of physical evidence. One piece of physical evidence was the presence of nitrite particles on the lower portion of the skirt that she was wearing on that night. and nitrite particles can come from gunpowder residue. And then the final piece of evidence was the gun. The state claimed that the gun that Frances Newton took out of the house, the gun that you just heard her talking about, was the murder weapon. Those are the three pieces of evidence. When we investigated the case, the first thing when my office, Jared Tyler and I, started to investigate the case, the first thing that we realized was that if you simply built a timeline, Frances Newton didn't have time to commit the crime. We figured that even if you were the most generous to the state's version of what had happened when, she had a total of 20 minutes. Now, 20 minutes is not very long to kill three people and entirely eliminate any physical evidence that connects you to the crime. What do I mean by that? I mean that when police arrived at the scene, they did an atomic absorption test on her hands, and there was no gunpowder on her hands. There was no evidence that she had fired a weapon. There was no gunpowder residue on her sweater, which is where, of course, you would expect to find it if somebody was holding a handgun and firing it. The crime scene, we noticed, was bloody because there was a blood trail that went from the spot where Frances's husband, Adrian, was killed back into the room where the bodies of the two children were found. What that meant was that either the murder weapon or more likely the murderer was covered with blood. Adrian Newton was shot at point-blank range, and there's an entry wound but no exit wound, and so that means that all of the blood and brain matter came back out of that entry wound and got on the weapon and probably got on the shooter as well, and there's a trail that leads from him back to the children. Well, there wasn't any physical evidence at all on Frances Newton. There wasn't anything at all on her clothes. There wasn't anything at all in her car. This is somebody who, by the state's theory, would have had to have killed three people with perfect marksmanship and then completely clean the crime scene in such a way that investigating authorities could find no physical evidence tying her, you know, to the scene at all in 20 minutes. And it just seemed entirely implausible to us. That was why we first began to really doubt her connection to the crime. Well, then we decided to look into the motive. It turned out the state had made it sound like she had gone out 2 weeks before to buy life insurance and then waited around for a couple of weeks and then murdered her family. That wasn't what had happened at all. She had originally purchased life insurance about a year before. She stopped paying the premium because she couldn't afford it. She then went to buy automobile insurance, and the insurance agent persuaded her that she should buy life insurance too. And it turned out that Frances was vulnerable to that sales pitch. Insurance agents tend to be pretty good salespeople anyway, but Frances was especially vulnerable to it for a couple of reasons. The first was that her father had always taught her that life insurance was a good form of a forced savings account. And in addition to that, she had recently had a family tragedy where her aunt's house had burned down and all the little kids in the house had died in that fire, and the family hadn't had enough money to bury them. And the talk in the family was that if only they had had life insurance, they would have been able to bury the kids. So you put together that family tragedy with the fact that her dad had always told her that life insurance is a good thing, and then she goes and visits his insurance agent, and the insurance agent says, you know, you really ought to buy life insurance. All of a sudden, what looked like the motive for this crime turns out to have been a completely ordinary event. Now we don't have motive, but we have two pieces of physical evidence, the nitrites on the skirt and the fact that she hid the gun that was supposedly the ballistics match.
David Dow, you're an attorney, and I don't know if this is a question for you, but is there something people can do at this point from your perspective? By the way, we called the prosecutor's office, and they didn't get back to us.
Yes, well, that I'm sure that they won't be getting back to anybody now. They've said what they said on videotape, and now they're just saying it was a mistake. I think people should write the Board of Pardons and Paroles in Texas. I think they should write the governor's office and say that this is a woman who's innocent.
David Dow, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us of the University of Houston Law Center. Information on Frances Newton's case is at freefrances.org. We'll link to it at our website, and we'll continue to cover this case. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Bill Caduce, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Again, that website is democracynow.org, where we're podcasting and have video and audio streams of the broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.